sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Rough week for markets. Everything was down in the U.S. and lots of red around the world. It's a short week, but big on eco data coming, and the Yemen conflict spooks the markets, but drives oil prices higher. All this and much more on episode number 406 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 406. We are at the end of March. And we have some holidays coming up towards the end of the week. We have Good Friday. We have Easter. The markets in the U.S. will be closed on Friday. Actually, not all the markets. The stock markets, of course, will be closed and the bond markets. But the futures market will be open. And that's very interesting because we're going to see the monthly employment number on Friday. And what happens there is that, obviously, they are making sure that the futures markets stay open. And that's, I guess, to keep some equilibrium in markets if the numbers come out a little bit wanky. But it will be light trading, be very soft volumes, and who knows? We've seen this before, obviously, many, many times, where the markets will be closed in the U.S., but the futures will be open. And, you know, it really has some significance, but not a whole heck of a lot. It really depends on what happens coming back the following week. But anyway, it is a holiday shortened week. There's a lot of economics to be delivered. I'll go over that in this episode. We'll talk about some of the things that are going to be, you know, shaping the markets this week. Still having a little bit of trouble with my rig here. We have the backup rig that we're working on. Hopefully, all of the pieces were put back together. And I got some notification that the repair shop has everything fixed and it's coming on. I don't know. Sometimes these things happen. You know, you try to keep good care of your gear, whether it's your car, whether it's something mechanical, your computers. But there's glitches. Things happen. We know how it happens. Matter of fact, last week I did an upgrade of my GoPro. I think I told you I got the GoPro originally. We talked about this on DH Unplugged a lot with Dvorak. Got the GoPro originally because I wanted to see what all the excitement was about. What was everybody buying this device for? What was all this going on, you know? So what I did was, for two reasons, I bought the GoPro. I want to check it out. I want to understand more about the software before I did some investing in the stock. And I was looking to be on the short side, as you know. And I got it, and it was interesting. We used it for a couple of different fishing outings and a few other things. Nothing major. I think I used it maybe four times in a period of maybe 2 months. Well, it was sitting on the side for a while. I charged it up. I was going to take it out. I decided, you know what? One of the things I saw was there was an upgrade with the GoPro software. And the upgrade was that if you turned the GoPro camera upside down, it would actually self-adjust so that you wouldn't have to do it in post-edit. You wouldn't have to turn the whole thing upside down to, you know, in terms of in the software and work your video. It would just automatically do it in camera so that it was right side up. Okay, that was kind of cool. So I upgraded it, and I just left it to the side. Well, I was going to take it out for a trip and do something with it. I don't know what I was doing, but I was going to take it out, and I turned it on to check it out, and the back of the screen was all black. I couldn't see anything through the lens. And I was kind of bummed about that. I'm thinking, well, maybe it's something about the battery, maybe just the SD card or whatever. Anyway, after a long bit of investigation, found out there was a glitch, possibly, in the software upgrade, which kind of aggravated me. So now what I have to do is get a download of the software, manually put it on the micro SD card. I have to go out and get a micro SD to an SD converter so I can actually download the software onto that, put in the camera, and then do a manual upgrade. And hopefully that's going to help. Now, I thought it was really interesting that when I talked with technical support, they were very helpful over at GoPro, but they did mention that this is not an isolated incident. It seems that this is happening, I guess, a lot. I did read some message boards. I found out the same thing. There was a good amount of these glitches that are going on with their software upgrades. So I don't know how that's going to affect things. Who knows if people are actually going and upgrading. If there's anything like what I have experienced, you use it a few times, then you put it away. Not that exciting of an instrument. Not that exciting of an electronics appliance. We did, in fact, enter into another small short position, a starter position of GoPro. Want to get to the 43 and change number. And we're looking to increase that dependent on what the price action of the stock is going into the next earnings. Now, earnings season is going to be kicking off on April 8th overall for the market. That's the first day we put that into the calendar because Alcoa does come out with their earnings. And that was traditionally for many, many years the stock that would lead it all off. You'll see some other names come out, and Alcoa was a bigger part of things back in the day. But these days, Alcoa is still indicated as the stock that would kick off the official earnings season. And we're going to see that on April 8th. And then we'll see a short week of a smaller week of earnings come in. Then it starts building about the third week into earnings season. So we'll talk about April. Let's just target April 20th, April 21st, somewhere around there, around that time period. You'll start seeing a lot of names rolling in. Now, one of the things that you'll know is that we've been talking about how there has been a significant downgrade of earnings for the S&P companies over the last several months. One of the big reasons has been that the strength of the dollar has been really creating a lot of trouble for many of these companies. We've seen that many companies are coming out with guidance that is significantly lower than anticipated. As a matter of fact, I have some statistics here that I wanted to share with you. So, according to a couple of different articles, this is from FactSet. The pace of first quarter earnings for the S&P companies, S&P 500 companies, is running slightly ahead of the pace of that set. Let me start all over with this. The warnings, not the earnings, the warnings from S&P 500 companies is running slightly ahead of the pace at the same time a year ago. And well ahead of the five-year average. And this is information according to FactSet. So I put a chart, and we'll try to put this in the show notes over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So if you look back at, let's say, quarter one of 2014, the number of pre-announcements among the S&P 500 companies that is to the negative side is about 84% of the total that are currently announcing. 81% back in 2014, 84% currently. The positive pre-announcements back in 2014 were 18%, and now we're only at 15%. Now, let me give you some more perspective on this, okay? I'm going to take you up through the pre-announcements in quarter 1, 2014, 2, 14, quarter 3, 14, and 4, 14, okay? And then current, which we haven't seen yet. So back in 2014, again, it was 81.5% negative surprise results, negative surprise announcements. In other words, pre-announcements that were negative compared to what was anticipated. These are just pre-announcements. Now, in quarter two, it was 74%. In quarter four, it was 73%. In quarter four, quarter three, it was 73%. Quarter four was 80%. And now it's back to 84%. So it came down dramatically. Now, the five-year average of negative guidance that we figured is about 68%. Now, in terms of positive, listen to this. This is really interesting. Positive pre-announcements by S&P companies going back a year in quarter one, 2014, was 18%. Next quarter was 25%. Next quarter was 26%. Then it dropped down to 19%. Now it's only 15%. So what does that mean? Well, companies, well, of course, what we know what companies do, they massage their earnings. They come out with numbers and they look to, you know, provide something under a lot of times what they think they can actually do. Why is that? Well, it's all a game of headlines. We know this. Company beats by one penny, a little bit higher on revenue, stock zooms and does well. Meanwhile, what usually happens before that, if they start bringing down their estimates and they start talking to the analysts and saying, hey guys, listen, I want to let you know. We don't think we're going to be making the earnings that we thought we'd make before. We think that, you know what, instead of 3 cents a share, you know what, it's looking like more like 2 cents. So why don't you adjust your numbers because of this and that, maybe revenues or maybe some other kind of accounting issue that came up, or maybe it's some sales in some region. It could be 100 different things. But the companies start to talk to analysts, and obviously they also do pre-announcements either at their last earnings announcement or sometime in between their last earnings announcement and the next earnings announcement that comes out. So what happens is that they kind of get the market used to things. You know, it's the toad in the water theory, that if you put a toad in boiling hot water, it's going to jump out immediately. If you let it just sit there and simmer and bring the heat up ever so slowly over time, probably going to boil that toad. This is the case of what happens with earnings. This is the case what happens with companies looking to pre-announce early, trying to get the markets used to, and then surpassing the lower expectation. Now, it's a game that they play. We know this, nothing to be upset about, nothing to be worried about, nothing to be concerned about. It's just factually what happens. We've seen it time and time again with earnings, EPS, with revenue. So here we are in a situation, though, that companies are really starting to guide lower. The interesting thing about all this is that markets are really close to an all-time high, and the PE ratios, or the earnings ratio of stocks right now, is about 18 on the S&P 500, historically above average, about 1 to 1.5 above average, usually about 16.5, let's call it. So we're seeing that PE ratios are stretched, and at the same time, the more concerning factor here is that we're seeing that pre-announcements and negative pre-announcements are the highest they've been in a long time. In fact, earnings should be slipping about 5 or 6% compared to where they were a year ago. Earnings should be slipping from where they were last quarter. But again, we harken back to the fact that stocks are close to an all-time high and PE ratios are pretty much stretched pretty hard. What does that tell me? That tells me that there's something wrong with the equation. There's something wrong with the money that is involved in chasing stocks right now. There's something wrong with the sectors that are getting all of the income right now and getting all the revenue. And it's a dislocation of the entire S&P 500 as to the output of what earnings are actually going to be. Now, even if companies come in and they beat their earnings estimates, which I expect them to do because that's what they do, by a small amount, I would still think that we are currently in a situation where markets are much higher than they should be. Now, again, you don't want to just use that as your only tool, because what will happen there is that you'll miss the trend if it's really a situation where there's a lot more enthusiasm due to low interest rates, due possibly to the only place to invest, that people don't want to be in other places around the world. There's a whole host of things that you have to use to put into this equation. You don't just use that as your only identification of the potential for a market correction. But that is one data point that you want to use. That's one thing that you want to say, okay, wait a minute. Here we go. What do we have? Earnings, which are clearly, by all means and all mechanisms and all theory, the one thing that really drives markets or stocks. The culmination of stocks is a market. So that earnings level that is being predicted by analysts, that is being projected by companies, is something that we want to pay attention to. And if now what we're seeing is that companies are really guiding lower significantly, much greater than was before, you would think they know something. And one of the big things we do know is that there is a very significant issue with regard to the fact that dollar headwinds are causing major problems for multinationals. Now, with that, I got to tell you something. Every once in a while, I get these pet peeves, these things that really piss me off and trouble me. Well, that dollar headwind, they're trying to really poo-poo it. They're trying to say, you know what? These dollar headwinds are, you know, something, but we have something that is going to trick investors. That's right, trick investors. And it's going to be called a constant currency basis earnings. What the heck is that? Constant currency. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to show what our earnings would have been if the dollar wasn't such a detractor from earnings. Yep. And what we're going to do is we're going to call it something. We're going to put a name on it. And it's going to sound cool. Constant currency earnings. And you know what? investors are going to buy it because they want to believe that the earnings are better if the dollar situation, the strength of the dollar, is simply transitory. And we're going to use that. Our vision is that the dollar strength is just transitory and we'll get back to earnings. And you can see that our earnings have grown over time, but yet we have this constant currency basis that can show you that, however, we had to take a 5, 6, 7% hit to our earnings due to the fact that this currency conversion is really hurting us. Now, I don't know about you, but I think it's all about what spends. Right? I mean, think about this. Well, you know, the dollar's really strong, so I could buy a lot more. And that's something that I'm going to say is only transitory. Therefore, I'm really buying less. Or on the other hand, the dollar's really weak, so I can't buy as much as I wanted to in the past of a foreign good. Let's just call it chocolate. I can't buy as much chocolate as I wanted to. But you know what? That's transitory. So the truth is I'm going to subtract that. I'm going to divide it. I'm going to take out the dollar. I really bought as much chocolate as I wanted to. I wanted to buy 4 bars. I only could buy 3 bars. But you know what? Truth be known, if I do a currency constant chocolate buying, I really could have bought 4. So therefore, look at my warehouse. While I only have 3 bars in the warehouse, think of it as 4. So my inventory's up on a constant currency basis. Hogwash. Crap. I mean, think about that. How stupid is that? That has got to be the greatest scam that I've heard in a really long time. There's a couple other ones that we could talk about. There's definitely a few other ones we could talk about. But, you know, you combine that with the fact that companies are buying their own shares hand over fist, as we've talked about time and time again, and the fact that they're issuing dividends. And now they're coming out with this whole hogwash about constant currency base. There's a variety of these things that are really starting to pile up that are getting me very concerned, because even though it may be a transitory situation, the fact is it is here and now. It is absolutely affecting their earnings in many different ways. Now, there is some benefits. The benefits are that they get better inputs. But you know what? You look at these companies and you got to scratch your head and wonder, you know, who's coming up with this crap and why are we buying into this? Now, there's a great article in Bloomberg this week. When I say great, I'm putting quotes around it. Great article in Bloomberg, guy named Michael Regan, who I wrote to, and I really kind of let it out. I told him what kind of bullshit this whole thing was when it comes to this concept of the asymmetry of oil may mean more profit surprises like what happened with Carnival. Carnival Cruise Lines came out with profit numbers this week. I got to read this to you because I think this was just hysterical. I mean, talk about really trying to twist things in a way to make it fit what you believe is right. Here we go. There are two interesting factoids in Carnival Corp's earnings today. This is what is written, which helped send the stock up as much as 7.4% for its biggest gain in more than 3 years. The stock closed up about 5.8% on Friday. But he says, first, on an adjusted basis, its earnings per share beat estimates by more than, wait for it, 100%. That's obviously what has everyone excited about the stock today. The reason the cruise ship company beat estimates? Well, because fuel costs fell so much, of course. Well, secondly, on a generally accepted accounting principles or a GAAP basis, earnings actually missed estimates by 36%. The reason? Because of fuel costs, of course. The GAAP results included $112 million in unrealized losses on fuel derivatives. Now, item one may be more important for the rest of the market going forward. As many people have noted, the drastic reduction in estimates for energy companies' earnings has not been offset by increased estimates for companies that benefit from lower fuel costs. Plenty of energy and industrial companies' forecasts have been cut due to the lower cost of oil and drilling activities, but companies that benefit from lower fuel costs are not necessarily increasing their guidance, at least not enough to compensate for their lost profits in energy. So here's what's interesting. So it goes on to talk about some of this other stuff, and there's maybe more surprises like this in the S&P 500 and blah, 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 this whole thing. Now, what's really interesting about this is that now we're seeing another component of going into the glass is half full, and let's not look at the problems that are being, you know, put out there, because, well, on one hand, Carnival beat. Now, you got to follow me on this. Carnival beat their earnings estimate by more than 100% because of the fact that they had this real good benefit of the fuel costs that really were much lower. Now, let's not look a gap here, because, you know, only look a gap if it fits your need and if it's really good for you and if beneficial for you. But what we want to do is look at Gap just for the background that they lost $112 million in fuel derivatives because they've had these losses. They hedged out. They tried to hedge out a little bit of their fuel costs, but let's not pay attention to that. Now, what's really interesting is this reporter would be the same one that would be looking at the constant currency concept, trying to find some way of making it look a lot better than it really is. Because why should we be looking at the fact that Carnival, while they did a lot better, they lost like crap on the derivatives. Now, on the other side, if Carnival made their earnings, and let's say that oil, just for the heck of it, doubled in price, wow, let's look at the gap. The good news is, you know what? They made all this money on their fuel hedges. So therefore, we have to put that back in the equation. That's a benefit to the company. It's the same thing with the dollar. They're trying to make us look at one thing and not the other. They're trying to do a bit of an illusionary game, kind of like a David Copperfield approach to looking at what's going on with earnings. Well, you know what? We don't want you to look at these things that may be transitory, even though there's a big loss in there, because it may not happen again. Now, what happens if oil stays exactly at the price that it stays currently and Carnival continues to do what they're doing? Let's say they continue with their hedges. They don't lose as much because their hedges kind of blew out already, right? I don't know if they're going to re-hedge that much at this point, you know, re-up the hedge. Maybe they'll keep it. Maybe they will. We'll see. But the fact of the matter is that while a company is doing a lot better due to the fact that they have all this benefit from the fuel benefit, it's interesting how they don't want to look at it on the other side, which is how it looks from the respect of, well, it's only transitory. It's only temporary. This is a time where fuel prices may not stay here forever, but it's okay when it benefits the company. It's not okay when it doesn't benefit the company. This is the play. The dollar situation is going to be looked at as a transitory situation that is going to be looked at on a constant currency basis, therefore helping to bring share prices higher, or at least promote share prices being higher, because it's only temporary. The oil situation is going to be looked at as a permanent situation because it's beneficial to shares. You follow this logic? It's crap. Michael Reagan, you should be ashamed of yourself. And I told him that. Now, we discussed that it was kind of a rough week for markets. Let's go talk a little bit about that. And I got some numbers for you. Let's bring that out here. So, let's see. This is the weekly return for the S&P 500 down 2.2%, NASDAQ 2.69%, Dow Jones 2.29%. They kind of run in tandem these days because it's pretty much the same thing across the board. Now that Apple has such a big component of the index or the indices, you're going to see a lot more similarities, really not a lot of changes and differentials between them. We also saw that the Brazilian market really sold off. It had to do with some of the oil situation where on Friday, oil dropped about 5.5%. We'll talk about oil in a second, but that was down about 3%. And European markets, except for Spain, was down pretty much. Actually, let me take that back. It was actually Italy. Everything was down for the week. Euro stock index down about 1.26%. Now, what's interesting to note here is, let's talk about month to date. I thought this was really kind of interesting. When you look at the month to date, you see that the S&P is down 2%, the NASDAQ's down 1.5%, and Euro stock is up 2%. But if you do it on a currency basis, in other words, if you were to invest your money in a Euro stock index ETF, that plus 2.2% for the month would be a negative 0.6%. Now, the ETF may be a little bit different, but generally speaking, that's what the story is. You see that the currency that is really moving lower lately, the euro, is hurting markets dramatically, because as you invest your money from the U.S., you're taking dollars, you're converting it into, let's in this case, the euro, and you're investing in a way that has currency as a component of your investment. So that being the case, what's happening here is that you're getting a situation where you're benefiting. You did great if you invested in the DAX, man. The German market is up 4% for the month to date. but you lost about 3% on the euro. Now, here's what's really interesting. Have you been watching what's going on in Brazil? Now, if you would have invested in the Brazilian market and you would have done it in an ETF, okay, and you would have said, you know what, this thing is bottoming out. I really think it's, you know, all sorts of problems with oil and the conflict with much of the political situation there, and you would have invested in the ETF, you would have been down about 14% for the month, because combining the return of the markets over there and the currency losses against the dollar, down about 14.5% month to date. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Brazilian market on its own, just if you were, you know, no currency involvement there, was only down 2.89%. Now, here is something that I've received a lot of questions about this. We talked about this many months ago, the whole idea of ETF investing, where you want to do it, how you want to do it, and some of the pitfalls of this. So I thought we would talk about this a little bit. And the big question is, and it came in from a lot of listeners, and you can always email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And one of the things we do for our global allocation portfolios, which is institutional mutual funds, very low-cost ETFs. We use more of a traditional structure of these, but give you a great diversification. We have, that's a $500,000 minimum, just to let you know. And as we're talking about it, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, if you want any information about that, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can check out the 12, 13, 14-minute video. There's a kind of a virtual tour of the strategy if you want to look at it, or the Arrow, which is our algorithmic strategy, which gets you long the S&P, short the S&P, or just out on the sidelines, dependent on trends, overbought, oversold indicators that we have programmed into this really cool algorithm that we have. You need to check that out. If you haven't checked out Arrow yet, go over to the Discipline. Just get right over there. Just stop everything. Put the pause button on. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the information about Arrow on the right-hand side there. There's a little Arrow icon or logo you'll see. And we'll send you information about the historical returns and what goes on within Arrow. Very cool information. Very, very cool. But those are a lot less. $50,000 minimum investment. So pretty much that's affordable with your IRAs, with your retirement plans, with your non-IRAs, any monies that are investments able, you can invest in those. So check that out. But back to the whole idea of ETFs. So first of all, we'll talk about currencies in a moment, but let's talk about the whole idea of when do you use an ETF and when do you use a mutual fund? A lot of questions came in like, why would I ever use a mutual fund? I mean, ETFs are much cheaper. You can get in and out of an ETF during the market day, right? You don't have to wait till 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock is the buy or sell time for mutual funds. That's just how it works. If you were to put money in a mutual fund and you would go and do it online or with the mutual fund company directly, and you would put in, let's say, $10,000 to the ABC mutual fund, it buys in at 4 p.m. that day. Markets are moving up, markets are moving down, markets are moving sideways. It doesn't matter. The 4 p.m. close is the price that you buy or sell each and every day. There is one time during the day that you buy and sell. That's it. Now, an ETF, on the other hand, at 2:15 in the afternoon, you decide, you know, I really like to buy that ABC ETF. Put $10,000 in, boom, you're in. 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon, whatever time it is. 9 o'clock, 9:30, before market hours, after market hours, extended trading, during market hours, in, out, sell, whatever you want to do, all throughout the day, back and forth as many times as you like. Different than a mutual fund. Also, ETFs oftentimes are cheaper than mutual funds. A mutual fund may be, I'm just going to give you a number, could be 1% fee for the management. An ETF may be 0.25%, so like 75% less. But what's the difference? Why would you want to be in a mutual fund versus an ETF? Well, in our opinion, there are certain times that you want to be in an ETF and there's certain times that you want to be in a mutual fund. And here's the basic criteria if you want to know. So an ETF is really good at tracking a market. So for example, let's look at the SPY, SPY. The SPY is the S&P 500 constituents inside and rolled up into a mutual fund. It tracks into an ETF. It tracks the index. You get the dividends. You have a small fee. You can move in and out all the time. There's a small cap version. There's a healthcare. There's a utilities. There's all sorts of different ETFs that are out there. They're there to track on a passive basis. In other words, it's just going to have the constituents of a particular sector or index that usually matches up to some other, whether it's the Dow Jones, the Diamonds, DIA. You can buy the NASDAQ 100s, the Qs, QQQ. You can buy the S&P 500, SPY, all wrapped up very neatly. You get the basic return of the S&P or the Dow Jones or whatever it is that you're buying, and you can track it, and it tracks pretty closely, really closely. Now, that's fine. Now, what happens, though, if you want to invest, let's just say, something crazy. Let's say you want to invest in emerging market bonds. Now, there are some ETFs that do that, and you're going to buy an index. But my preference would be, let's seek out those mutual fund managers and companies that have an expertise in this area. Maybe they understand more about the language, the political structure. Maybe they understand more about the internal workings of the markets there and what's happening. Maybe they have a much greater understanding of what's going on overall with the company because they're really doing analysis. And it's not just tracking an index. It's not just simply going out and saying, oh, well, we're going to buy the, okay, for example, EWZ. That's the Brazilian. You can buy the Brazilian stock market that way. But you know what? You weren't hedged. And we talked about before that if you were in the Brazilian market ETF, you're down about 14% for the month. If you maybe had a mutual fund that was, and this is hypothetical, but maybe a mutual fund that was invested in Brazil, maybe what they did was maybe they hedged out the dollar a bit. Maybe what they did was they went to companies that were much stronger than the ones that really hurt the Brazilian market, which was like Petrobras and Vale. So when we're looking at the differential between when you want to be an ETF and when you want to be in a mutual fund, here's what we do. We say, if it is a market that is very efficient, if it is a market that we can say that we're not worried about any significant understanding about the underlying securities like the S&P 500 or the large cap, if you will, even the small cap markets in the U.S., you know what? An ETF is a great place to be, possibly even some real estate, REITs. If, on the other hand, there is a need to have a special understanding and a better understanding and more of a analysis that is involved in the process, maybe I want to buy small caps of the emerging markets. That probably requires a little bit more expertise than just an ETF, just an index. I want to go with a mutual fund manager that has the expertise in that area and the track record. And of course, I'm looking not only at that, we're looking at things like turnover, management turnover. We're looking at Sharpe ratios, the alpha, the beta. We're looking at things like the comparison, of course, against an index that would replicate whatever we're looking at, how they performed. We're looking at the risk-adjusted returns of it. We're looking at actually what is the fee to do this. I mean, if in fact we found a great mutual fund manager that has a great risk-adjusted return, but maybe has a 3.5% fee to do so, maybe that's a little steep. So there is a process that you use to understand that the more efficient markets are okay to be in an ETF. On the other hand, if it's an inefficient market, if it's something that, you know, is again, maybe foreign, maybe specialty, we want a mutual fund manager. And I think that is a real good way to look at this. Because you want to make sure that maybe the currency is hedged out if it's going to be a problem. And there are some, now there are some ETFs that will actually do currency hedging. But again, you still lack the expertise possibly in the areas that are inefficient. So keep that in mind. Inefficient markets, mutual funds, efficient markets, ETFs. That makes sense? That's if you're looking, by the way, that's if you're looking for broad-based diversification. If you're just looking at getting in and, you know, out and doing a quick trade, an ETF obviously is a better way to go. It's the only way to go, unless you're using an individual stock. Because you cannot get a mutual fund to trade any other time but 4 p.m. in the afternoon. So I think that's a major issue that you have to look at. All right, let's skip over to, what should we talk about? Let's talk about some of the economics that are coming up this week. I have a list here, and let's kind of go through some of that, because like I said, it's a short week. Friday is a Good Friday and Passover, and markets here will be closed except for futures. But let me just give you a list of things. I mean, it's a long list of things that are coming out this week, in this short week. I'm going to give this to you. You can look this up on, you can go to like, Econo Day. Yahoo Finance has some of this. Bloomberg has some of this. You could take a look at briefing.com if you haven't had the free subscription, if not the paid subscription. Subscription. Get that out there. Great service. Just absolutely fantastic service that you really should check out. Briefing.com. All right, let's take a look at what we got. All right, starting with the 30th. Personal income, personal spending. We're looking at personal spending is supposedly going to be up 0.2%. Prior was negative 0.2%. Spending has been coming down, even as though income has been on the rise and more jobs have been added to the market. And that's very interesting, I think, because we should be seeing spending go up, but somehow it's not happening, which is kind of interesting. Maybe it's some of the spooking going on with topping off and the some of the pricing of housing. We've seen housing prices get a little bit toppy here. Maybe not as much selling going on of existing homes. It could be 100 different things that can go on. Meanwhile, consumer confidence hit about 93. It's still very elevated. We saw that on Friday. But spending is just not keeping up. We'll see what happens. Now, I'll also mention to you, as I've mentioned many times before, and it hasn't let up yet, the analyst surprises to the downside when it comes to economic indicators. Look at the economic surprise index, is really looking awful. I mean, we saw a negative 70 last week. That's bad. That's really, really bad. You don't see those kind of numbers quite often. We saw it about 2 years ago, two and a half years ago, and markets have usually about a 2 to 3 month lag till they start accepting the fact that things aren't as good as maybe we thought they were, and the realization then comes slowly as we see that economic indicators are missing pretty badly. Now we'll see if economists have done a better job at adjusting their numbers so that we're not seeing such severe misses. But even last week we saw a lot of misses. I haven't seen anything that really was a lot better in a while. We're going to see, pending home sales, looking at an increase of 0.4%, pending home sales year over year up 8%. We see the Milwaukee ISM 51 also on Tuesday. Then we're going to see the Case-Shiller numbers. Now, the Case-Shiller numbers have been kind of slowing up a little bit. This is one period that they look like, at least from an estimate basis, that the 20-city composite on a year-over-year basis is going to increase 4.6%. Now, there was a time that we were seeing that up 7 and 8%, obviously, on a regular basis as we were coming up from the lows of the housing crisis and the housing crash. But we're starting to normalize a little bit here. Now, on a month-over-month basis, it looks like it's going to drop a little bit, but on a year-over-year basis, which I prefer to look at, it's going to be up a bit. We're going to see consumer confidence that same day at 10 in the morning, 96.4. Expectations are to stay exactly where they were. Chicago Purchasing Manager Index is supposedly going to be a bit higher, 51.8. I'd like to see that. We saw the Philly Fed kind of be very disappointing recently. Then an important number on the 1st, at 10 in the morning, we're going to see ISM manufacturing. Estimates are for 52.5. Right now we saw about a 52.9 last, and that's down a bit from where we were, but we're still above the 50 threshold, which is really important. We saw that China has been slipping below the 50 for quite some time now, and their economy is really in troubled shape. Now, one of the things you'll note that is, as we're seeing, this is starting to finally happen, as we're seeing that economic numbers are slowing, all of a sudden we're starting to see the dollar get hit. The dollar was doing great for a while because the economic numbers were good and employment was good. The Fed took their discussion and said, well, you know what, we're going to be looking to raise rates eventually and start to prep the market for all this. And the dollar was on a 9 month and has been on a 9 month tear higher. That's what's been a big problem for oil. That's what has been a big problem for earnings. But all of a sudden, we're starting to see that economic numbers are starting to slow down. And that would be a sign for those that are buying dollars that, hey, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't be buying so much. Maybe it's not as strong, because a strong currency is a reflection of a strong economy. And when you do a comparative of one economy to the next, so you look at the United States and you look at Europe, for example, what you do is you say, okay, well, which economy is stronger? And then you can say, well, that currency should be stronger. Not as simple as that, but what you do is that's where you would go to the short side or the long side of the currency. So right now we've been seeing for some time that the U.S. economy has been strengthening. In particular, and probably the centerpiece of it all has been the jobs number. The jobs number has been doing much better. And of course, the dollar has been rising with that in mind, and the fact that the Fed is starting to get much more hawkish, much more, not totally hawkish, but much more hawkish than they've been. So now, we're going to see the ISM manufacturing, which again has been weakening a bit. We're going to see the market U.S. manufacturing also that morning, looking about 55. But the other things that we're going to be seeing that I'm going to be looking for is the ISM prices paid. Now, the estimate is for a 38. That means the prices paid compared to last month, which was a 35, are going to be higher. Dollar down means that things cost more because obviously it costs more to get foreign goods. Well, we've been seeing that number has been coming down for some time, and that's been good because the dollar has been rising. So the input prices of manufacturing is better. That's good. But you know what? I'm kind of concerned about the slow but sure slippage of the ISM manufacturing number that we've been seeing. Now, in the second, we're going to see the first part of the totality of jobs because we're going to see let me see where this number is here. Initial jobless claims. Where is the ADP number? Why don't I see the ADP number here? Oh, here we go. The ADP employment change on the first also going to come out. 225,000 is expected to be added to payrolls. Again, a pretty good number. And we've been seeing over 200,000 new hires, new employees put on for some time on a monthly basis. Very good. We see initial jobless claims on the second, expecting to see 285, sub 300, which is very good. Then we're going to see the New York ISM factory orders. Factory orders have been slipping. Estimates are they're going to slip even more. And this has to do with the fact that there is not a lot of spending, looping it back into spending and retail sales. You know, companies don't want to have an extraordinary amount of inventory sitting around. So they're not going to be putting in their orders into factories. Factories, therefore, are not going to be producing. Therefore, factory orders drop. See, a drop expected to be about 0.4%, half a percent, we'll call it. Compared to a drop of about 0.2% last month. I think the factory orders, the ISM manufacturing numbers, the consumer confidence that we're going to see, and along with that, the personal income and personal spending are the real important things that we're going to see at the beginning of this week. It's going to give us a real good take on what's happening with the consumer, how they're spending, and how that's flowing through into the manufacturing and factory orders numbers. Now, the big daddy of them all, estimates are going to be for change in non-farm payrolls of 248,000. Now, last month, if you remember, a whopping 295,000 new jobs came in. Unemployment rate went to 5.5%. Expectations are to stay at 5.5%. But I think what's really kind of interesting here is that we still have not seen a significant amount of the job losses from the oil industry flow through at all. Or said a different way, the job losses that we saw in the oil industry is being offset dramatically by several other areas, inclusive of some manufacturing and retail has been holding on pretty tight. So I think that's going to be a pretty important issue to look at that. The change in household employment, this is a number that, I don't know, take it or leave it, but up 250,000, 96,000 was last month. I don't know what that's going to be. That's a separate survey, but we'll see what that is. The other thing that I'm going to watch for here is this. The average hourly earnings, okay? The average hourly earnings are expected to tick up ever so slightly to 0.2% month over month, 2% higher than last year. The big issue that the Fed is looking at and that I am looking at is wage growth. Now, wage growth will then, if you have good wage growth, which we should see as more employees are put on and as the labor market gets tight, you should see that flow through into wage growth. And wage growth, what does that do, right? What do you think about that? Wage growth then flows into personal spending increase. because it's more discretionary income. On top of that, gasoline prices sub $3, we'll call it $2.50, round number, saving good money from the cost of transportation for individuals I'm talking about, more money in the pocket, more wages, even higher consumer discretionary consumer spending. Now again, you have higher consumer discretionary spending, and you have a higher amount of potential wage growth. That's all good for the economy. All right, let's skip over to something. Enough of the economic data and all that. Let's talk about a couple of questions that came in with regard to what are my favorite indicators. There's a couple of questions that I got from listeners. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can ask me questions. You can check out all the things that we talk about. All the past podcasts are on there as well. Of course, you can subscribe at iTunes or on iTunes and several other areas, whatever you want to do. Or you can listen to it just right on the web, right on your web browser or your iPhone, whatever it is, or your smartphone. I say iPhone. It's kind of a, like, I guess, Band-Aid brand. Anyway, let's talk about favorite technical indicators. I don't have a lot of technical indicators that I like that are out of the box. Now, we, of course, you know that we have developed many for TradeStation, and these are volume-based studies that look at where the inflection points are for buying and selling, where the buying is happening, where the selling is happening, and where the, as we call it, the holes, you know, where there's a lack of any buying and selling. So a lot of those we really like to use. There's a whole suite of them over on TradeStation under Trigger Charts. But let me talk about some of the traditional and more traditional ones that you may have heard of and that I like. Now, I'm going to give you just three. And if you only had to use three, this is the three that I'd probably say, okay, you could use them. The first is moving averages. Now, the moving averages I like are the 50-day and the 200. You could also use the 100. So we'll count that in a basket of moving averages that are something that you can use in order to find out where there is support and resistance. And the reason that I bring those up is because, not that there's any magic to these, whether it's a 20-day, a 50-day, 100-day, 150-day, 200-day, whether it's the EMA, which is the exponential moving average, whether it's the simple moving average, often called the DMA, daily moving average, or just the moving average, MA. You know, you can look at any of those, but the reason is very simple. And that is because institutions love them. The institutional guys love the 50-day moving average. And because they love the 50-day moving average, you know what? This is something that you have to pay attention to. A break of the 50-day moving average, particularly for an index, is pretty significant. Oftentimes, you'll find that there is a good amount of support at those levels. And when the support at those levels, because of the fact that it's the 50-day moving average, and put aside anything else that you may be thinking about, what's the importance? If institutions are looking to be supportive and constructive at that point and do some buying to keep markets above that for whatever the reason is, it doesn't matter. They have a lot of money. That's the big money that you want to follow. So you can follow along oftentimes and look for the breaks on the upside and downside, the support and the resistance of the 50-day and in particular the 200-day. Now here, over here on this side of the microphone, we're thinking in, but by our measures, that there is probably going to be a test of the 200-day moving average of the S&P 500 coming up. It hasn't tested that in a very long time, but we've been breaking the 50-day moving average. Yes, climbing above it, but then breaking it again. And when you see 2 to 3 breaks of the 50-day moving average, usually you see the next level of support comes into play. So we're going to look for the 200-day moving average as something that you should pay attention to. I'm telling you, just pay attention to that. The other one that I like is, if I was to pick any, just, you know, something that's out of the box, something that you can get anywhere, whether it's stock charts or maybe even on Google Finance or Yahoo Finance or, you know, wherever else you look, is fast stochastics. Now, basically, this is an oscillator and slash trending type of indicator where it looks for I'll call it momentum. And it looks for where a change in momentum is occurring and when there's an overbought and oversold situation. Now, the fast stochastics, I think, are better than the slow stochastics. And, you know, you can put on different levels because they're all, the inputs are all customizable. And let's say you want to put a 3.5 or a 6.9. So you want to put the short one, you put in a 3, and you put in the longer one, the longer average, you put in a 5. And when you see it get below, let's say, a negative 80 and start turning up, and then across of the short to the longer, we call it the trigger in the setup. When you see that cross, hey, that may be a time to start getting in. And in the opposite, when you go above 80 on the stochastics and you start rolling, and you get a cross of the two lines, the setup and the trigger, then maybe it's a time to get out. Now, that's more for short-term trading, but I do like the fast stochastics as a good indicator. Just the calculation is clean, it's good, it's easy, it's all technical and price-driven entirely. Now, if you're going to look for something else, take a look at the Spearman indicator if you could find it. We've built it here. We track it. Very good when it crosses below zero. Again, below about 85, negative 85, negative 90 is a pretty good level to start looking to see when that turn happens for an oversold situation. Again, it's not the only thing, but it's a good indicator. Again, it's basically a mathematical calculation of trend. And when you're getting a little bit too toppy and when that trend starts to weaken or trend starts to strengthen. So you got the Spearman indicator, you got stochastics, and you got moving averages. Now, one of the things that we've built here, we've done some work at building indicators to find overbought and oversold. We use these internally. Some are available on TradeStation, but for the most part, we use these internally. But I'll tell you some interesting things happening. The key reversal indicator, which gives you indications of where there is a point that is identifiable by a bunch of different clusters and formations and levels that says, okay, here's where you're really oversold and markets are, you don't get really oversold or really overbought too often. It's a lot of things that got to come together to give you those kind of inflection points that you can be like, yep, that's a confirmation, let's do something. But the key reversal indicator currently is at zero, meaning that markets are in equilibrium. Now, we put together a variety of different things internally to come up with that. Point, though, is I wanted to share that it's not so much of educating you on what the key reversal indicator and how we built it is, but right now we're seeing that, yeah, there was some movement down, there was some movement up, and kind of you had some levels that could have been said to be overbought, oversold recently. We really never got terribly, terribly overbought because the trend has been pretty smooth. But our arrow indicator, which is an algorithm that we're seeing, what we use to find very deep pockets for the S&P 500, is at a negative 60. Now, negative 60 is pretty ugly. You don't get that often. And I find it interesting that we're seeing that we could probably see some further downside of that down to about negative 70. If we get that level, even though it's been a very quick move into that negative territory, I think it'd be very interesting to see if, in fact, there is the opportunity for a reversal of this market, at least to take out some of the excess selling that's been going on. You know, what happens in some of these indicators is that you see that there's an overbought or oversold level, but not necessarily a level that is saying that it's going to be a trend that changes, but it's just a point inside the trend that all of a sudden is, in a way, buyable, or I would say sellable or shortable. And you want to find maybe those inside levels. Right now, we're finding that this is a level that may be a buy on the S&P 500, especially into the end of the month. You have seasonality into the end of March and into the first 2 weeks of April that are pretty strong on the buy side. Even though we're seeing all this Yemen conflict and all the things that are going on around the world in terms of Greece, you see any kind of good news that comes out, I think there'll be a pretty good pop right here because you have some oversold levels that are popping in. Not terribly oversold to the point that you're just jumping and screaming on top of your car and saying, hey, you got to buy everything that's out there. No, we're not there, but we are oversold. Anyway, moving along. We talked about the asymmetry of markets. We talked about investing in ETFs and the whole issue. We talked about the short week with economics and what's going on there. Talked about the earnings that's happening. Talked about GoPro. Talked about some of the M&A. We should probably talk a little bit about that. Looks like Kraft is being bought by Heinz, merging, help with a big money from Warren Buffett. Shares up about 35% last week. Intel doing something to step up their growth. Looks like they're going to be buying Altera. At least that was the news at the end of the day on Friday. And China, all sorts of problems and possible bubble going on there. News that teenagers and cleaning ladies are opening stock trading accounts. Not a good sign. Not a good sign at all. Give you one other idea. Lumber Liquidators. We've been looking into this whole deal, and obviously Lumber Liquidators was a great short and good money to be made there. But now it looks like that it is starting to base out there. And if you have all these shorts in, and all of a sudden it's going to take months for California to come out with some new results from the tests. And if, in fact, their tests are not as stringent as the ones that were done on 60 Minutes, where they're not going to do the deconstructive type of checking for the formaldehyde, I'm just saying there's a potential nice little uptick that could happen for this. So keep a look on Lumber Liquidators, GoPro, Intel, and some of the chip companies that probably will follow along with the whole potential of Intel buying Altera. You have Qualcomm looking at maybe Xilinx or Skyworks Solutions could be in play. So lots of opportunities out there. Until next week, when hopefully we have this whole recording kit fixed, I want to thank you. Head on over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the name on Twitter. And if you want some more information on Aero or Global Allocations or the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, of course, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. Have a great short week, great Passover, or a great Good Friday, or both. Enjoy both, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.